Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're plunging into a topic that truly impacts all of us: how to live well for longer. We're talking about extending your health span.
That's right. It's not just about adding years to your life, but crucially, adding life to your years.
Okay, so health span, what exactly does that mean?
Well, health span is that vital period where you're free from chronic diseases and debilitating conditions. It's about maintaining vitality, independence, and, you know, a high quality of life as you age.
Got it. And to guide our exploration today, we've taken a deep dive into the groundbreaking work of legendary scientist Eric Topol.
Ah, yes, Topol.
Specifically, his best-selling new book, Superagers, and also his popular Substack newsletter, Ground Truths. He's compiled an incredible amount of research on what genuinely moves the needle for healthy aging.
He really has. Our mission today, then, is to pull out the most important and, frankly, surprising takeaways from his extensive work. We'll cover key pillars of health span, diet, exercise, sleep.
And some cutting-edge science, too, right?
Exactly. Some emerging insights. So, yeah, let's explore these foundational areas.
All right. To begin our deep dive, let's start with something as fundamental as what we eat. Eric Topol highlights a pre-stark fact. Poor diet is linked to 22% of all deaths globally. I mean, that's a higher percentage than tobacco, cancer, or hypertension.
It's staggering.
Yeah. Yet with, what, 60,000 diet books on Amazon alone, figuring out what a healthy diet actually is can feel incredibly overwhelming.
It really can. And what's particularly striking in Topol's work is his intense focus on ultra-processed foods, or UPFs. He doesn't mince words about them.
How does he describe them?
He calls them alien, industrially produced, unnatural substances. They're not even food. Basically, these aren't ingredients you'd typically find in a home kitchen.
Okay.
And the damage they inflict seems to come from two main angles. First, chemically, they're just loaded with additives and industrial ingredients, things like artificial coloring, high fructose corn syrup, artificial sweeteners, maltodextrin, dextrose, lactose.
Usual suspects.
Right. Hydrogenated oils, palm oil, emulsifiers like soy lecithin, xanthan gum. The list goes on.
And the second angle.
That's the physical processing.
Right.
The manufacturing involves molding, extrusion, pre-frying. It's all designed to maximize digestibility and speed up absorption.
Which causes those blood sugar spikes.
Exactly. Blood glucose and insulin spikes. It's the complete opposite of how natural fiber-rich foods work, which slow down digestion. Topol actually points to the NOVA classification system as a helpful guide here.
How does that work?
It basically categorizes foods into four groups: unprocessed, processed culinary ingredients, processed foods, and then ultra-processed foods. It helps you see just how much industrial tinkering has gone into something.
And the impact of these UPFs, Topol shows, it's really significant. There was an NIH trial led by Kevin Hall.
Yes, that one was eye-opening.
It really was.
Yeah.
People on an ultra-processed diet ate an extra 500 calories a day just naturally and gained weight, while those on the unprocessed diet, they actually lost weight.
That's a pretty clear signal, isn't it? This overeating is intricately linked to a disruption of our natural gut-brain signals.
And the health risks aren't trivial.
Not at all. There's a sharply heightened risk for a whole range of cardiovascular and metabolic diseases. We're talking abnormal lipid levels, insulin resistance, widespread inflammation.
Wow.
Yeah, studies have shown notably higher risks for conditions like metabolic syndrome. That's an 80% increased risk. 40% for type 2 diabetes, 23% for hypertension, 55% for obesity, and even a 66% higher risk for cardiovascular death.
That's huge. And what about cognitive effects?
That's concerning too. For older adults, even a modest 10% increase in UPF intake is linked to a 16% increased risk of cognitive impairment. And things like processed red meat, bologna, bacon, hot dogs, regular consumption is associated with a 14% higher dementia risk.
Topol also shares that that self-experiment by Chris Van Tulleken, the British physician scientist.
Oh, yeah, that was compelling.
He spent a month eating 80% UPFs, gained 15 pounds.
And the internal changes were dramatic.
Huge changes in brain connectivity between habit and reward centers. His hunger hormones, leptin specifically, went fivefold higher, and body-wide inflammation doubled.
It's a powerful example.
Mm.
And it highlights that while genes play a role, diet has this massive impact. Interestingly, his identical twin on the same diet gained more weight, 44 pounds more.
Wow. So there's individual variation too.
Definitely. It shows that complex interaction between diet and our individual biology. But the clear message for health span, according to Topol, restrict UPFs to the lowest level possible.
Okay. So practically speaking, when we're at the grocery store, what's the takeaway for us?
Keep it simple. Read labels carefully. Avoid ingredients that sound like they belong in a chemistry lab, right?
Right.
Steer clear of added or fake sugars. Choose items with the fewest ingredients possible. And be really wary of those health claims. On packaging, they often mask highly processed contents.
And the layout of the store.
Topol often advises shopping the perimeter. That's where you usually find the fresh foods. The middle aisles. That's typically UPF territory. There's even an app, Open Food Facts, that can help you scan and identify these things.
That raises an important question, though. Why isn't the U.S. joining other countries like Brazil and Israel in issuing official guidelines against UPFs?
Well, Topol points directly to what he calls the supersized chokehold influence of multinational corporations, or big food, on regulatory bodies like the Department of Agriculture.
Lobbying.
Massive lobbying. He notes they spend twice as much as the tobacco and alcohol industries combined. And historically, the FDA has been, shall we say, slow to act on harmful additives already banned elsewhere, like in Europe, red dye number 3, brominated vegetable oil.
Things still in our food here.
Exactly. Topol suggests that, looking ahead, UPFs might eventually be regarded much like cigarettes are now. We might see calls for conspicuous labeling on foods and drinks, highlighting their risks.
Okay, so beyond UPFs, Topol then dives into other dietary details, sweeteners, salt, and the big macronutrients. Carbs, protein, fat.
Yes. His analysis is quite detailed there, too. Excessive sugar, especially from sugar-sweetened beverages, is undeniably bad. Full stop.
Increases mortality risks.
Yeah, increases all-cause, cardiovascular, and cancer mortality. High intake can even triple the risk of atrial fibrillation. Artificial sweeteners. It's more complicated.
Mixed messages there.
Conflicting reports, yeah. But overall, the data isn't exactly favorable, though maybe less concerning than high sugar itself. Topol does note stevia seems to be among the least concerning artificial sweeteners.
And salt. We always hear about salt and blood pressure.
The link to hypertension is clear, though how much it affects you varies individually. Moderate intake, maybe 1 to 2 teaspoons a day, is generally fine. But above 5 grams of sodium daily, cardiovascular risk increases.
And the average American
consumes about 3.5 grams daily. So not terrible on average, but many are higher. Plus, high salt diets might also pose risks for cognitive impairment by reducing brain blood flow. So limiting added salt, maybe considering potassium chloride substitutes, can help.
Okay, now on to the big 3 carbs, protein, and fat. What's the key message from Topol here?
The type of macronutrient truly matters, not just the amount. He talks about carbotoxicity, but specifically for the bad carbs.
So distinguish between good and bad carbs.
Absolutely. Good carbohydrates, think dietary fiber, non-starchy vegetables, legumes, fruits, whole grains, they actually reduce mortality and disease risk. Bad carbs, like fast-digesting sugars and refined grains, they spike insulin and lead to weight gain.
And protein, especially as we age.
Right. The current recommended daily allowance, the RDA, might actually be too low for older adults because we naturally lose muscle mass with age, sarcopenia.
So more protein might help.
It might, but it's tricky. Extremely high protein diets have been linked to issues like atherosclerosis and pro-inflammatory gut metabolites. Topol suggests up to maybe 1.2 grams per kilogram of body weight is reasonable.
But be careful about the source.
Yeah, he advises caution with leucine-rich animal proteins. Honestly, the science on optimal protein intake as we age is still evolving. It's hard to conduct those large-scale long-term trials.
Understood. And what about fats? They've had such a roller coaster ride in dietary advice over the years.
It's a fascinating area, isn't it? There's actually a dedicated gut-brain reward circuit just for fat intake. And it synergizes with sugar to promote overeating.
Making fatty, sugary things irresistible.
Pretty much. But surprisingly, dairy, which was demonized for its fat content for so long, is now linked in some studies to reduced cardiovascular disease and type 2 diabetes risk, especially things like unsweetened yogurt and harder cheeses.
So the type of fat is key again.
Absolutely crucial. Healthy fats, the monounsaturated and polyunsaturated fats from plant sources like olive oil, avocados, nuts, seeds, they're associated with substantial reductions in cardiovascular and type 2 diabetes risk, unlike trans fats, which are clearly harmful.
What about diets like keto?
Even popular diets like the ketogenic diet, while they can be useful for weight loss short term, Topol points out they carry risks like potentially higher cholesterol, brain fog for some, and even fatty liver disease.
It really hammers home that quality over quantity is the consistent theme, isn't it?
It really is. It's about making conscious, informed choices about the quality of what you're putting in your body.
And finally, in this section on diet, Topol covers some common beverages and food categories we encounter daily.
He does. coffee, for instance, it gets a pretty enthusiastic thumbs up.
Really?
Yeah. Linked to reduced mortality, up to 30% in some studies, especially around 4 cups a day, and lower risk of many diseases. Now, these are observational studies, so correlation isn't causation, but...
But no clear harm.
Right. There's no evidence of harm to heart rhythm, and some studies even suggest a lower risk of arrhythmias. The exact why is still uncertain, but the benefits seem to outweigh any potential risks for most people.
Okay, coffee good. Alcohol?
Less blurry there. The evidence is much clearer. Moderate to heavy drinking does no good, period.
What about the red wine myth? A glass for heart health?
Largely refuted, according to Topol. Alcohol is classified as a carcinogen, and the risks increase significantly, even exponentially, beyond very light intake. Think maybe just 2 drinks per week.
Okay. And red meat versus plant-based?
Processed meats are carcinogenic, linked to high risk. Unprocessed red meats, labeled probably carcinogenic.
So limit both.
That's the strong suggestion. A shift towards plant-based diets, in contrast, is plainly healthier, linked to reduced risks of type 2 diabetes, all-cause mortality, cancer. A study on identical twins even showed plant-based diets slowed biological aging.
But what about those processed plant-based alternatives?
Good point. Need to be careful there, too. They can still be high in sodium and saturated fats, falling into that UPF category sometimes. Topol's bottom line is pretty clear. The more red meat, especially processed red meat, the less healthy you're likely to be.
He then sort of brings it all together with the idea of a whole package of healthy eating, and specifically mentions the Mediterranean diet.
Yes, he really emphasizes this whole package approach. It consistently shows benefits like reduced cardiovascular and all-cause mortality. We're talking fruits, vegetables, legumes, whole grains, nuts, seeds, healthy fats like olive oil and avocados, fatty fish.
The classic.
Exactly. Olive oil itself is tied to about a 20% lower all-cause mortality and reduced dementia risk. These whole foods are rich in fiber, which directly counteracts the harms of those UPFs we discussed.
And the Mediterranean diet has good evidence.
Robust support. Multiple randomized trials show significant reductions in deaths from nearly every major cause. Cardiovascular diseases, cancer, neurodegenerative diseases. While newer variations like green MED diets show promise, the traditional Mediterranean diet remains the most validated for positive outcomes.
That's a lot to practical guidance on food. So for many of us, the next question is, what about supplements? Should we be taking handfuls of pills?
Supplements. Topol takes a pretty firm stance here. He basically states there's little to no hard evidence for the benefit of most vitamins or supplements.
Really? Even common ones?
Yeah, especially if you're already eating a healthy diet. Even the really popular ones like vitamin D and omega-3s haven't shown clear benefits in large-scale trials.
Any exceptions?
A modest possible exception might be multivitamins for cognitive aging in older adults. But even that is still debated. There are some newer longevity vitamins, like taurine and choline, showing intriguing promise in early studies.
Like in animals?
Exactly. Particularly taurine for promoting health span in animal models. But they lack that crucial human randomized trial verification. So, his practical advice, take them with a grain of salt. Don't rely on them instead of a healthy lifestyle.
Okay, let's shift gears. Moving from what we put into our bodies to how we move them. Eric Topol calls regular exercise the single most effective medical intervention that we know.
It's a powerful statement, isn't it?
He says if you could design a drug that did everything exercise does, it would be a miracle breakthrough.
And he's right. The impact is profound and truly body-wide. Exercise leads to favorable adaptations in nearly all organ systems: cardiovascular, brain, pancreas, muscles, gut, liver, fat, tissue, immune system. It's incredible.
How does it work?
It protects against atherosclerosis, improves heart function, reduces inflammation, enhances mitochondrial function. I mean, a randomized trial even showed inflammation biomarkers were suppressed more by exercise than by a GLP-1 drug.
Wow. That leads us to something fascinating Topol discussed with Yuan Ashley from Stanford, MotiPAC.
Ah, yes. The Molecular Transducers of Physical Activity Consortium.
It's this massive NIH project, the world's largest study of exercise, right? Looking at thousands of molecules in rats and humans.
Exactly. 800 rats, 2,400 people, looking at 17,000 molecules. And what's compelling are the initial findings from the rat studies. They showed that regular exercise literally changes every tissue dramatically.
In surprising ways.
Often in surprising ways. Like they saw dramatic changes to the adrenal gland, high enrichment of immune pathways in the small intestine, things you might not immediately connect to exercise, really reinforces this idea of hormesis. Yeah, the idea that the body learns to deal with the recurrent beneficial stress of exercise activating deep repair mechanisms like heat shock proteins.
Ashley commented that exercise is a multi-system, multi-tissue, multi-dimensional response. And because of that,
an exercise pill just isn't going to be possible. The effects are too complex, too widespread.
Right. And the data also showed differences between sexes.
Significant sex-specific findings, particularly in fat tissue biology. It really underscores how vital it is to study both sexes independently. We can respond almost like two different species sometimes.
And the human part of MOTUPAC?
Well, we can't biopsy every organ in humans, obviously, but it includes skeletal muscle and fat biopsies, plus blood samples to look at things like DNA methylation, immune changes, connecting directly to longevity research. And the best part, all this MOTUPAC data will be open science, fueling research for years.
Ashley shared a great statistic. 1 minute of exercise bought you 5 minutes of extra life.
And potentially more if it's high intensity, maybe 7 or 8 minutes. That came from that huge UK Biobank study. Topol adds that just brisk walking 450 minutes a week was associated with living 4.5 years longer.
And it's not just about physical health, is it?
Not at all. Exercise is incredibly potent for mental well-being. Studies show things like dancing, walking, jogging can be more effective for depression than many common drugs. Plus, it's strongly linked to improved outcomes for various cancers, partly by boosting the immune system.
So for someone listening trying to figure it out, what does enough exercise actually look like? How do you start?
Topol's advice, and Ashley echoes this, is primarily about building a habit. Consistency is key. Aim for 5 or 6 days a week, maybe at a consistent time.
Does it have to be super intense?
Not necessarily. It doesn't have to be grueling. Simply accumulating steps, moving regularly, that's really important. Ashley suggests a combination of aerobic and strength training. Maybe a 2:1 ratio favoring aerobic, but both are crucial. And don't forget flexibility.
Often overlooked.
Totally. Especially important for older adults or anyone who sits a lot.
Okay, but is more always better? Or do you hit a point of diminishing returns?
That's a good question. Some studies suggest maybe no plateau for mortality reduction, meaning more is always slightly better. Others indicate benefits might level off around, say, 300, 600 minutes a week of moderate exercise or 150, 300 minutes of vigorous exercise.
But no harm from doing too much.
Importantly, the evidence strongly points against any loss of health benefits from too much physical activity for most people. The only real exception might be ultra-endurance athletes, who could face a slightly higher risk of atrial fibrillation. But for the vast majority, more movement is good.
Despite all these clear benefits, it's quite striking. Only about 1 in 4 American adults actually meet the recommended guidelines for both aerobic and muscle strengthening.
It is striking. And Topol highlights that even small changes can make a huge difference. Just 10 minutes of physical activity per day could prevent an estimated 110,000 deaths among American adults annually. Just 10 minutes. He also talks about steps. While 10,000 steps isn't some magic, scientifically validated number, the benefits start way lower. Like 2,700 steps for older women showed benefits. Significant reductions in mortality and cardiovascular events are seen up to around 8,800 steps per day. And walking faster gives more protection against type 2 diabetes.
Now, Topol, as a cardiologist, made a point about his own past thinking.
Yes, he mentioned his past mistake of only stressing aerobic exercise. Now he strongly emphasizes strength, resistance, and balance training, too.
Why is that so important?
Because muscle mass and strength decline significantly after age 50, that sarcopenia we mentioned. Resistance training, even just 60 minutes a week, is associated with a 25% reduction in all-cause mortality.
Wow.
Plus benefits for cardiovascular health, cancer mortality, sleep quality, bone density, mental well-being. It covers so much. Topol encourages checking things like grip strength. It's a key prognostic metric. And practicing balance, like simple one-leg stance.
And avoiding sitting too much.
Crucial. He stresses avoiding prolonged sitting, as it's independently linked to increased all-cause and cardiovascular mortality, even if you exercise regularly. You can't fully exercise away the harms of being sedentary all day.
The synergy between exercise and diet seems important, too. Topol mentions a study on pre-diabetes.
Right. Combining calorie restriction with multimodal exercise, meaning different types of exercise, showed much greater improvements in insulin sensitivity than diet alone. They work better together.
Definitely. And for anyone thinking, oh, I'm too old, it's too late to start.
Topol shares that inspiring story of Richard Morgan, 93 years old. Took up rowing in his 70s. Now he's winning world championships. Has the fitness level of someone decades younger.
Amazing.
It truly suggests there's effectively no age limit to countering or maybe even reversing some age effects through exercise. It's never too late.
Okay, so we've covered diet and exercise. Next up, sleep. Topol dives deep into that magical sense of restoration we get from good sleep and why it's so vital for health span.
Absolutely. And the really big discovery here in the last decade or so is the brain's glymphatic system.
The brain's what now?
Glymphatic system. Think of it like a dedicated plumbing network in the brain. Its job is to clear out metabolic waste products, similar to how the lymphatic system works in the rest of the body.
So it cleans the brain while we sleep.
Exactly. This brainwashing, as some call it, primarily happens during non-REM sleep, especially that deep, slow-wave sleep.
Macon Niedergaard, the pioneer in this field, described it like turning on the dishwasher before you go to bed and waking up with a clean brain.
That's a perfect analogy. And this waste clearance is absolutely critical for brain health. Just one night of sleep deprivation can lead to a measurable increase in beta amyloid.
The protein linked to Alzheimer's.
The very one. And chronic poor sleep is prospectively tied to the risk and progression of Alzheimer's disease. We're now getting confirmation from human studies about this glymphatic network.
This raises a really concerning point, then, about something many people use, sleep aids. What does Topol say about those?
Yeah, this is worrying. He highlights a new study showing that Ambien, Zolpidem, a very common sleep medication, it actually suppresses norepinephrine levels.
And norepinephrine is important for?
It's key for driving that glymphatic flow, the brain cleaning. So ironically, the drug reduces the very waste clearance that sleep is supposed to enhance.
So the drug might help you fall asleep, but harms a key function of sleep.
Precisely. And other drugs might have similar adverse effects. Topol stresses that basically no commonly used sleep medications or supplements have been proven to improve waste clearance or deep sleep without significant side effects.
That's quite a statement. So how much sleep do we actually need? And how does it change as we age?
Around 7 hours seems to be the sweet spot, the optimal duration for most adults. Both too little less than 7 hours and actually too much more than 8 hours are associated with negative health outcomes.
Like what?
Increased all-cause mortality, declines in cognitive and mental health. And yes, as we age, deep sleep naturally decreases, sleep tends to become more fragmented, and our internal clock, the circadian rhythm, can shift earlier. Earlier bedtime, earlier awakening.
Topol mentions that a huge chunk of Americans, maybe 35-40%, sleep less than 7 hours regularly.
Yeah, and Americans generally get less sleep compared to some other developed countries.
So for promoting healthy sleep and therefore brain health span, what does Topol emphasize?
It really comes down to behavioral and lifestyle factors. Maintain a regular bedtime and wake-up time, even on weekends, as much as possible.
Consistency.
Consistency is huge. Regular exercise and regular meals, but with enough separation from bedtime. Think about that idea of early time-restricted eating, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
Create a good sleep environment. Cool, fully dark, quiet.
And screams.
Avoid blue light from electronic devices close to bedtime. It really disrupts your circadian rhythm. And crucially, diagnose and manage sleep apnea if it's present. It affects a lot of adults, often undiagnosed, and it's linked to a doubled risk of cardiovascular and metabolic diseases.
What about relaxation techniques?
Things like relaxation techniques, meditation, and also digital cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, or CBTI, have shown real efficacy for improving sleep quality.
He also mentioned sleep trackers briefly.
Yeah, he notes that while they can help you identify triggers for poor sleep, their accuracy varies, the algorithms aren't standardized. And for some people, they can actually worsen anxiety about sleep. So use them cautiously.
Okay, so beyond diet, exercise, and sleep, these core pillars, Eric Topol also delves into some environmental factors that maybe get less headline space, specifically social isolation and microplastics.
Right. Social isolation and loneliness are really critical public health concerns. A big review, 90 studies, over 2 million people. Yet it linked loneliness to significantly increased all-cause mortality, cardiovascular mortality, and cancer-related mortality. Now, cause and effect isn't fully nailed down, but it's a powerful association. And interestingly, people with obesity seem more prone to it.
It makes you wonder, could technology like generative AI eventually help mitigate loneliness?
It's an intriguing question for the future, definitely.
But then there's microplastics, something Topol discusses in his Ground Truths newsletter that sounds, well, truly alarming.
It is deeply concerning. We know they're everywhere, but the latest research is hitting hard. A landmark study last March found microplastics and nanoplastics, MNPs, in the arterial plaque of nearly 60% of patients undergoing artery surgery.
Inside the plaque itself.
Inside the plaque. and their presence was linked to a massive 4.5-fold increase in subsequent all-cause mortality, heart attack, and stroke over the next few years.
4.5 times, and it gets worse.
Unfortunately, yes. A new Nature Medicine study Topol reviewed shows that these MNPs accumulate in the brain at concentrations 7 to 30 times greater than in the liver or kidneys.
In the brain.
In the brain. And what's really alarming is that brain MNP concentrations were considerably higher in people with dementia compared to healthy brains. And these levels seem to have increased dramatically just between 2016 and 2024.
Does this prove plastics cause dementia?
It doesn't definitively prove cause and effect yet, but it's flanked by other concerning evidence. Another study in Science Advances, using a mouse model, showed MNPs in the bloodstream can cross the blood-brain barrier.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, cross the barrier, activate the brain's immune system, and lead to blood clots and neurological abnormalities. Topol refers to this whole issue as a plastic-demic, inciting aggressive inflammation throughout our bodies.
Okay, that's terrifying. Facing something so pervasive, what can we realistically do?
It feels overwhelming, but Topol suggests some practical steps. Actively try to avoid plastic-packaged foods and drinks whenever possible. Use less synthetic fabric as they shed fibers. Clean household dust regularly as it contains plastics.
And heating plastics.
Crucially, avoid heating plastic containers. Think microwaved ready meals in plastic trays, or even some plastic kettles. Heating leaches large amounts of microplastics into food and water.
But individual actions only go so far.
Exactly. Beyond individual steps, Topol emphasizes the urgent need for drastic cuts in overall plastic production and our reliance on single-use items. He calls it a crisis demanding immediate global attention.
Okay, so this deep dive has covered a lot of these low-tech lifestyle factors, what Topol calls lifestyle plus call. But he also highlights how cutting-edge, high-tech advancements are changing the game, right? Revolutionizing our understanding and ability to forecast health.
Indeed. One major area is personalized nutrition, moving beyond the old one-size-fits-all diet advice.
Because we're all different biologically.
Exactly. As Topol explains, each person is unique. Wearable continuous glucose monitors, CGMs, are becoming much more accessible now. They let you see in real time how your blood glucose responds to different foods, exercise, sleep, stress.
And our gut microbes play a role.
A huge role. That landmark 2015 study from the Weizmann Institute really demonstrated that a person's unique gut microbiome is a key determinant of their glucose spikes after eating.
So my response to bread might be totally different from yours.
Precisely. This has led to randomized trials showing that algorithm-based personalized diets can significantly improve glucose regulation, especially for people with prediabetes. The NIH is investing heavily now in the Nutrition for Precision Health program.
What does that involve?
Collecting vast amounts of data, CGM data, microbiome data, genetics, DXA scans for body composition, even food photos analyzed by AI to really advance this field. It's still early days, but the goal is to integrate all this individual data using AI to figure out the optimal dynamic diet for you.
That's fascinating. Another incredible frontier Topol discusses is the emergence of protein organ clocks based on work by scientists like Tony Weiss-Corey at Stanford.
Yes, this is really cutting edge. It involves measuring thousands of proteins in just a tiny blood sample, and then using AI to identify specific patterns, clusters of proteins, that reflect the biological age of individual organs.
Oh, so not just your overall biological age, but the age of your heart, your brain, your liver.
Exactly. And these organ age gaps, where, say, your heart is physiologically much older than your chronological age, are linked to increased risk of specific diseases down the line. Accelerated heart aging predicts heart failure risk. Accelerated brain aging predicts Alzheimer's risk.
So we could one day track the aging of each of our organs individually. That's quite a concept.
It really is. And these organ clocks seem to be sensitive to interventions too. Studies show smoking accelerates aging across multiple organs, while moderate to vigorous exercise is associated with slower aging. This approach could be huge for identifying high-risk individuals really early for targeted prevention.
And speaking of early detection, perhaps one of the most exciting breakthroughs Topol discusses is that new blood test for Alzheimer's disease, pTau217.
This is a potential game changer. It's a highly accurate biomarker found in plasma, just a blood draw that tracks the underlying brain neuropathology of Alzheimer's. No need for an invasive spinal tap or expensive PD scans anymore for initial screening.
And it detects risk early.
Incredibly early. It can predict Alzheimer's disease risk more than 20 years before symptoms even begin. It's the earliest biomarker detection of risk we've ever had for Alzheimer's.
20 years. And here's the truly transformative part, according to Topol. p-tau217 levels are dynamic.
Yes, they aren't fixed. They actually respond to interventions, including lifestyle changes like exercise. He cites a study showing substantial improvement in p-tau217 levels with comprehensive lifestyle changes.
So it's not just predicting risk, it could track progress in prevention.
Exactly. This opens up an entirely new vision for Alzheimer's prevention, much like how we use cholesterol levels to guide statin use for heart disease prevention. Topol believes p-tau217 will become a key part of risk assessment.
Identifying high-risk people decades in advance.
Years, even decades, so they can intervene proactively with these powerful lifestyle factors we've discussed, or perhaps with new drugs as they become available. This could finally allow for the primary prevention of such a devastating age-related disease, something previously thought almost impossible.
Wow. This deep dive into Eric Topol's superagers and ground truths really paints such a comprehensive picture of how we can actively work to expand our health span. It's clear the choices we make every day, what we eat, how we move, how we sleep, they have this profound interconnected impact.
They really do. And these emerging high-tech tools, personalized nutrition, organ clocks, that Alzheimer's blood test, they're poised to give us unprecedented insights, allowing us to individualize strategies for prevention and health optimization like never before.
So boiling it down for you, our listener, what does this all mean?
Well, it means those low-tech lifestyle factors, diet, exercise, sleep, they remain absolutely paramount. They are incredibly potent drivers of health.
Yep.
But the exciting part is the future seems to offer this convergence, blending these foundational habits with powerful new data and insights. It helps us proactively manage our health span with much greater precision. The profound impact of making these choices is just undeniable.
So maybe consider this. In a world just flooded with health information, sometimes contradictory, often overwhelming, what simple, consistent change might you prioritize this week? Something tangible to actively build your own health span, knowing the incredible, multifaceted benefits it can bring.
Yeah, take a moment to reflect on that. We really hope this deep dive has given you some valuable nuggets of knowledge to chew on, and maybe even spark some new ideas for your own path to a longer, healthier, and definitely more vibrant life.